The year is 2003, and we are heading to Hell's Kitchen. This is Daredevil.
He can hear it before it makes a sound. He can sense it before it happens. He can vanish before you realize he's there. And he's the last person you'd ever expect.
Police suspect the vigilante Daredevil was the one to bring the criminals to justice.
I don't know why you read that trash.
You want the truth?
Tell me.
She's hideous.
Excuse me. I just wanted to get your name. Does every guy have to go through all this to find out your name?
You should try asking for my number.
I've been following that piece you wrote about the Kingpin.
How do you kill a man without fear?
Let the bodies hit them.
Give me bullseye.
The devil's mine.
Hey there, guys. This is Mike, and we are looking at 2003's Daredevil by a director named Mark Steven Johnson. Don't be surprised if you've never heard from him. Most of us actually haven't. But this film does star Ben Affleck and Jennifer Garner and Jon Favreau and Michael Clark Duncan. So there are some people in it that were going to be aware of it. I had picked out this year and asked Randell to pick the film, and this is what he gave me. Thought he was my buddy. Actually, it could have been much worse. We could have picked League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, but at least so we didn't do that. So yeah, Daredevil. This was a comic that was really, really popular. Kind of on the darker side. Had been in publication on and off for, about 30 years or so before this film. And in 1997, Marvel Studios was going through a lot of financial difficulties, and so they started, or not Marvel Studios, Marvel was going through a lot of financial difficulties, and so they started handing out their characters, selling off rights to make films out of their characters, which is why you wind up with things like Sony making Spider-Man movies, and Universal making Hulk movies, and Paramount making Iron Man and Thor. This is all based on kind of that. In fact, Marvel would be going through bankruptcy within a year or so. But in 1997, the character of Daredevil and his associated characters were licensed to 20th Century Fox. They kind of sat on it for a while and actually let the rights expire. The way these rights usually wind up working is that the studio has a particular amount of time to get a film into production, and if they don't, then the rights revert back to Marvel. So Fox let the rights expire on this. It went briefly to Columbia. Disney had tried to purchase it, but Columbia wound up making them a better deal. And so the rights went to Columbia for a while. At that point, Chris Columbus was attached to write and direct it. But at the end of the day, even though the rights had been sent to Columbia, Marvel and Columbia could not agree on digital distribution. Columbia wound up not producing the film. New Regency made an offer that included digital rights that Marvel was happy with. And so in 2000... New Regency picked up the film. From what I understand, while the film was at Columbia, Chris Columbus had stepped away from it. Mark Steven Johnson had been brought in to write a script and had gotten hired for that. But then when the film went to New Regency, he had to go back in and basically repitch himself, which he apparently successfully did. Not particularly sure why. There was, obviously an abundance of directors that could have picked this film up. They picked this guy. Johnson had, he'd written a couple of films. He was a writer on Grumpy Old Man and Grumpier Old Man. His only film that he had directed was a film called Simon Birch in 98, another film that basically nobody's heard from, starring Oliver Platt, that was not very well received. It's really bizarre that New Regency and Marvel agreed to let this guy write and direct this film. But here we are. Studio wanted it to be filmed in Canada. Affleck, who was attached very early on, did not want to go to Canada to film this. He had filmed another movie in Canada, I forget which one, and did not have a good time with it. So the film was, they decided to film in LA, probably because that made it really cheap. I don't think it would have been horrendously expensive to film in New York, but very little of the film was filmed in New York. I think there's like one scene in Times Square that they filmed, but everything else was filmed in L.A., a lot of it on sound stages. So Johnson wanted to pull, and wound up actually doing this, he wanted to pull a lot of the scenes directly out of the comics. He was a huge fan of Daredevil, and he wound up being able to do this. A lot of the scenes, we'll talk about a couple of them, really directly lifted out of the comic books. So that's good. There's really not a lot of casting involved in this. It seemed to be pretty straightforward that they went for particular people and got them fairly well right away. I wasn't able to find a lot of alternative castings when it comes to this. There's not a lot of documentation on the making of this film. There is a documentary on YouTube, but it focuses a lot on the craft work, costumes and stunts and all that, things like that. It doesn't really get into like pre-production in terms of how the development of the film. But Affleck was attached very early on. The one casting that was really controversial at the time, obviously, is that of Michael Clark Duncan as Wilson Fisk. Fisk in the comics is a very large, red, fat, white guy. And you know how comic book fans can be if things are not exactly like they are in the comic books. And yes, there was a lot of consternation at the time. There was definitely a lot of pushback on it, but that's fine. I mean, I think Michael Clark Duncan is really, really good in this role. We'll talk about him a little bit later. Rhythm and Hughes was brought in to do a lot of the CGI. They had done some of the stuff on a couple of the Lord of the Rings movies. They had done a couple of other things. They created the effect of Matt Murdock being able to see with sound. They called it the Shadow World. So all of that stuff that we see in there is basically completely CGI, except for the couple of scenes where he's looking at somebody in the rain. And what that was they had filmed the scenes and then animated the CGI over the filmed scenes. So it's kind of a composite in those scenes. Everything else is strict CGI. And I got to say, Rhythm and Hughes did a fairly good job with this, in terms of developing that shadow world and having us see, quote, things from Matt's point of view. Story-wise, it's a little weird, and we'll talk about that, but in terms of the actual effect, I think that it's pretty great. So that's really it as far as pre-production goes. As I said, there's really not a lot of it there. This seems to be pretty well developed, pretty much fast track and new Regency. And they didn't spend a lot of money on it. We'll talk about budgets later. But they, you know, they wound up, I think originally it was budgeted at about $48 million. And then they wound up kicking in more money. They kept running up against the shooting days. And Johnson kept having to go back to them for more shooting days. And they were doing it. And they eventually rounded out. They added like another $30 million to it. So $78 million was the budget. So let's get into the movie. So this movie obviously starts in a flashback with Matt Murdock being a teenage kid or a preteen kid. It's not really quite clear. He's living with his father in Hell's Kitchen, which is a neighborhood in New York City, and his father is a boxer who's kind of down on his luck a little bit. Who has a reputation for being able to really to take a beating, and that's going to become important in a little bit. But Matt winds up hearing this rumor. He's teased the school by these bullies, these three bullies or four bullies. He hears a rumor that his father is working for a bad guy named Fallon, and he confronts his father with it. His father assures him that he's not. Newsflash, he actually is. But he winds up convincing his father to get back into the ring and kind of work things out. But he apparently one day he decides to go visit his father at work at the docks where his father supposedly works. He can't find him, and then he finds him in a back alley shaking some guy down for money. Figures out that his father really is working for Fallon. You know, he goes and runs away. And now this is kind of weird part number one. There's apparently a dock with a bunch of toxic waste and radioactive material just sitting around in Midtown Manhattan. That seems a little convenient and also a little weird. Hey, I guess it's pre-9/11, so who knows what was going on. But anyway, he gets, you know, somehow one of the drums comes apart. He gets hit full on in the face with this biohazard, radiological, whatever. Wakes up in the hospital. His eyes are patched over. He's blind, but instantly he is able to hear things and has this kind of sonar-esque hearing. Like, no training, no development, no this, oh, his senses are growing over time because he's blind, compensating. There's none of that. It's just, as soon as he wakes up, boom, he can see stuff, and, you know, he knows exactly what's going on in other rooms, you know, down the hall, whatever. And he's not scared at all. He's very calm about the whole thing. He wakes up, his father walks in on him, and he's, you know, staring out the window for some reason. And there's a lot of window staring in this movie. And, yeah, it's just, I guess they're just getting us to the point. Seems kind of weird. Apparently, his first day back at school, he runs into the bullies and then basically ninja fights them, because he's developed that fighting skill kind of instantly, I guess. And I gotta say, you know, Matt's kind of a bonehead in this thing. I mean, the guy, yeah, the kids pick on him, but they're walking away and Matt stops them and then decides he's gonna pick a fight with them. And, you know, basically that's kind of what happens. And then we see, this is where we get into, he encourages his father to get back into fighting, and his father's back fighting, but his father refuses to throw a fight. And we know what happens with gangsters when you refuse to throw a fight. You know, we've probably all seen Pulp Fiction. And they come after him, and he gets, you know, beat up by this mysterious stranger who leaves a rose on his body, who ultimately turns out to be Kingpin, Wilson Fisk. And, you know, there's some confusion in New York, in the press, in the law enforcement at this point as to who the Kingpin is. So that becomes an important development in the story. And now, boom, we move forward into modern day, and Matt Murdock is the Daredevil. And he's somebody that people know. He is, you know, so we kind of do get a little bit of his origin story, but we skip completely over the origin of him becoming Daredevil. We get the origin of his blindness and his shadow ability, I guess we'll call it, his sonar ability. So we get that, and then we skip right to him being Daredevil, which, okay, I'm all right with. I don't particularly mind when these superhero movies kind of jump right into it and we don't see the origin necessarily. You know, some of the later Spider-Man movies did that. The Tom Holland Spider-Man movies did that. He's already Spider-Man. Blade was like that. He's already the Daywalker. When we see him, we get a little backstory later on as to how it happened, but we don't watch him developing his skills. We don't watch Matt Murdock developing his skills. And you know what? I'm kind of all right with that. If you're watching enough of these comic book movies, you kind of know how this thing happens. We don't really need multiple training montages. Let's just get into the action of the movie. So that part's actually not that bad. One thing I will say is I do miss Jon Favreau as an actor. And not to say that he doesn't still act, but that, you know, that younger Jon Favreau, you know, especially in like that Swingers, Deep Impact, Replacements era Elf. And not to say that I don't love his directed features, because I do. He is a great director, you know, especially Iron Man, Chef. I just watched Cowboys and Aliens last week. That's not a terrible movie. He's a great director, and I obviously love the stuff that he's doing with Star Wars. I would not take any of that away from him. But just something about seeing him on the screen being snarky and being basically Jon Favreau, like he was in The Replacements, like he was in the first Iron Man movie. I kind of missed that. It was kind of refreshing and good nostalgia seeing him do that. So, you know, we get Jennifer Garner in as Elektra, and apparently Matt Murdock's vision sense or shadow sense, whatever, works on detecting if a pretty girl is walking down the street outside the coffee shop. But it does, and she comes in. The really funny part about the scene is I don't think she ever orders her coffee. She walks in, he kind of goes right up to her, and she's like, no thanks, no thanks, no thanks, and then walks out the door with a coffee in her hand. I don't know where she actually got the coffee. This movie, I think, if you watch it, is pretty chopped up. I think there's a lot of it that was taken out. I watched the director's cut, which has a lot of the Matt Murdock Elektra story cut out of it, and a lot more Coolio for some reason. I don't know why they felt they needed to add that B story in at the expense of a pretty significant part of the A story, but they actually did. Maybe it's to show Matt and Foggy as being well-rounded attorneys. I have no idea. So yeah, this really weird kind of interaction with Elektra the first couple of times he meets her, and then he winds up having this fight with her in the playground, which is tonally completely different from the rest of the movie. I mean, it's shot almost comedically in a way, like kind of slapstick, with them fighting around on the playground equipment and doing all these weird wire tricks. There's way too much wire work in this movie. Kind of like they took The Matrix and looked at it and said, yeah, we want to do that like 50 times more. And so they wound up doing like all these really crazy things. Like some of it works really well, but a lot of it is just so excessive. You know, when you see somebody like, you know, jumping and then they slow down in midair for the landing, it's just too much. I will say that this first fight scene, the playground fight scene, there were no stunt doubles at all. Everything that you see on the screen is Affleck and Garner. They worked really hard at getting all the choreography right, but the choreography is so obvious in all of the fight scenes. It's really, there's almost nothing organic. There's nothing fluid about it. It's very much like this. Move one, move two, move three, move four. Woo, wire work, you know, spin in the air, jump on the ground, move six. I mean, it's very obvious that it's choreographed and that they are actors working through the choreography. I think in a lot of the scenes where the actors did the work, they would have been better off using stunt doubles who are probably more versed in martial arts, more versed in, you know, the movement and the kinesthetics of fight training, and it just would have looked more natural. This looks very rehearsed and very, very staged, basically all of the fights in the movie. And the big question is obviously, like, how did he beat her? I mean, yeah, fine, he's the daredevil, and he's got this, like, shadow sense, but she is like a trained martial artist. She goes through this whole conversation where she's talking about how she had multiple senseis and she's been training all of her life. You know, she's got a room in her house with hanging sandbags or sandbags that drop from the ceiling so that she can fight them, I guess. It's like, how does he wind up beating her in this fight that actually makes very little sense? I think the whole thing, the whole relationship with, especially in the director's cut, with Matt and Elektra, just don't make a lot of sense. It's so fast. They go from he's the annoying guy in the coffee shop to he's the annoying guy out on the street that they're fighting, and now they're in love all of a sudden. And it's very poorly written. It's really poorly edited. It's just, we don't have any time to really invest in the story or invest in these two together, so that by the time she winds up getting killed by Bullseye, you're wondering if Matt even really knows her. And we're gonna talk about that fight in a little bit, because that fight really makes no sense. You know, so Bullseye, we have Colin Farrell in as Bullseye. I actually kind of like him. He's a little over the top in this, and that was intentional. You know, his point of view is he's a method actor, but he had said that, you know, you can't be method for like a sociopathic killer who's going around killing people in New York with paperclips. There's no way to be method about that. And he's kind of right. So he just decided to just dial it up to 11 the whole bit. They had suggested to him that he use his natural accent, and they had written that the character is from Ireland. This is the first time that Colin Farrell had used his native accent in a film. He was the one who came up with the idea of, like, the coat twirl that he's constantly doing, I guess. So they kind of made his costume in such a way that, you know, that would work a little bit more. There's a cool little cameo in here by Kevin Smith, who's playing a guy called Jack Kirby. Kevin Smith had written several issues of the Daredevil comic. So that was cool little early Kevin Smith cameo in there. And of course we have Joey Pants as the reporter, Ben Urich, who is a character directly out of the comics. This is great. This is fine. I love watching this guy in pretty much anything that he's in. You know, Joe Pantoliano is like the ultimate character actor who's been in just a ton of stuff and kind of always playing a version of himself, which is fine. So let's get on to Wilson Fisk. As we talked about, Michael Clark Duncan doing a fantastic job as this character, I think. He is a fantastic actor in this type of role. I really enjoy the fact that they took the traditional kind of Wilson Fisk, which is, you know, a fat guy, a big heavyset guy, and they turned him into a very muscular guy. And he takes that shirt off in that last fight, and he just looks absolutely massive. Now, he's a pretty big guy, 6'5". Was 6'5". Obviously, we lost Michael Clark Duncan in 2012. But he's 6'5". Ben Affleck is like 6'1", 6'2", I think. So he's a pretty big guy. I still think they probably stilted him up a little bit, give him lifts, put him on a box or something to make him look a little bit bigger. But I just think he's really good in this role, and I really, really enjoyed that part of the movie. So let's get on to the big, you know, the finale, the big fight. So Elektra is going after Daredevil because she thinks that he's responsible for the death of her father. And, you know, she stabs him in the shoulder, and somehow this completely incapacitates him. I mean, this is kind of like the deal with his father. You know, his father was a boxer who had a reputation for being able to take a pounding and keep going, and yet a couple of street thugs beat him up to the point where he was, like, laying on the ground. Same thing going on here. I mean, Daredevil constantly is in fights and constantly is getting these huge beatdowns and continues to come back and fight, but she stabs him in the shoulder, and all of a sudden he's, like, on death's door. I don't really think that kind of makes a lot of sense. And then, obviously, once she figures out it's him, then everything's okay, you know? It's kind of like BVS, you know? Why'd you say Martha? It's a similar thing, like, oh, it's you, Matt? Oh, it must be okay. Like, I guess because she loves him, she instantly trusts him, but it's kind of crazy. And that last fight with Bullseye is just so over the top, the pipe organ fight. I mean, have you ever seen a church with a pipe organ that big? That's crazy, and all the wire work and all the flipping and the whole thing about that Daredevil is like incapacitated by loud noises is just, it makes no sense. You live in New York City. Have you not developed some kind of way to deal with the fact that you live in one of the loudest cities there is? But, you know, a subway or a pipe organ getting hit is going to, you know, incapacitate you? That's crazy. Yeah, so the whole fight, I mean, it didn't really pack a lot of emotional weight, and it just, all the wire work was just really made it kind of ridiculous. Again, them jumping around. And then you get to the end where you get to Matt and Fisk, and I'm sorry, there's like no emotional weight behind it. Like, you haven't spent enough time with these two guys together to make it seem like you understand why they are what they are and that there's some kind of emotional stakes to this fight. I just didn't see it. And at the end, why are they unmasking Daredevil? Why is Daredevil revealing himself to Fisk and leaving that out there? I think it would have been a lot more compelling if he hadn't. And, you know, Fisk was just kind of sitting away in prison plotting his revenge against Daredevil. And if you were planning a sequel, then the reveal could be in the sequel. So I just think they wasted the ending of this movie. So how did this movie do? Well, And actually, it did pretty good. The $78 million budget, we talked about that. It wound up doing $179 million. I had a $40 million opening weekend, went on to do $179 million. It was part of a pretty good streak for Marvel properties in the movie theaters. You know, we had Blade, you had X-Men, you had Blade 2, you had Spider-Man, then Daredevil, which was February. And then I think in April, X2 comes out. And then later that summer, Hulk comes out. And Hulk's not a great movie, but it did do fairly well. X2, of course, is a monster and maybe one of the better superhero movies of all time. So this is a really good streak for Marvel in terms of their movies. And they're really kind of getting up to the point where superhero movies are actually becoming a thing and not just some kind of novelty. So this film's got a 43% on Rotten Tomatoes. It's got a 42 Metacritic, B on Cinema Scores. Roger Ebert gave this 3 out of 4 stars. I mean, I don't get that. He liked the movie. He thought it was a good movie. Maybe, I just don't know. He did have some critiques about it, but that he rated it that high was really kind of crazy. Empire gave it a 4 out of 5 stars, too. There were a lot of critics who actually really, really liked this film. There was a lot of critics who panned it. Affleck wound up getting the Golden Raspberry for this film. It was his third one, I think. I think he got one for Geely, and I forget what the other film he got one for was. He still disowns this film. But he had said after this film came out and after the backlash from it that he was never going to do a superhero film again. He thought they were ridiculous. He wasn't the guy for it until DC backed up a dump truck full of money to his house so that he could be Batman. And then all of a sudden he's, you know, well, I want to do a superhero right this time. And then we got BVS. So you could be the judge of how he wound up doing with that. And as we talked about, this was re-released in a director's cut, which had less of the Elektra story and added this beast, this other kind of side plot with Coolio playing a defendant that was represented by Foggy and Matt. So take that for what you will. So that's Daredevil. Yeah, I'm not liking this film. I'm like maybe a 2 out of 5 for me. So is what it is. So for the next show, we're actually going to do I'm going to do something a little special. I'm going to do kind of an override to the regular randomness of the rewatch. And in light of the release of Dune Part 2 in the beginning of March, I am going to be rewatching the 1984 David Lynch adaptation of Dune and then talking about it. So I will see you next time, and thanks for listening.